Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchak. Today we take you to the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor for a conversation between Nathaniel Fogg, former Deputy Chief Operating Officer and Counselor to the Administrator at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and Nick Dowling, Founder and CEO of IDS International, a firm that helps the U.S. government handle complex national security challenges. This talk is one of many from the 2020 College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute, whose theme is November 3rd, What's at Stake? It was originally presented online on July 28th, 2020. The title of today's talk is Addressing National Threats and Emergencies. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. It will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing the conversation today is Arthur Martinez, former CEO of Sears.
It's my privilege this morning to introduce the first really interactive session of the day. It's entitled Addressing National Threats and Emergencies. And to put it mildly, we have a surfeit of national threats and emergencies on our hands right now as a country, a challenging time indeed. The format of this morning's conversation will be a discussion and a dialogue between Nick Dowling and Nathaniel Fogg. Nick is here with me at the College of the Atlantic. Nathaniel is at another location, but technology solves that problem pretty easily. A few words about Nick. He will be on the podium a few times later in the week. First of all, a two-decade career in government service focused on interagency cooperation between both the public and the private sector. He was deputy director for European Affairs at the National Security Council, the highest level of that activity in our country. He was working very hard to end the Balkan Wars. He was responsible for the Bosnian and Kosovo policies at the time. He worked, obviously, in the Secretary of Defense's office as a senior fellow. But over the last 15 years, Nick has been the CEO, founder and CEO of IDS International, a firm that helps the U.S. government handle conflict and complexity in the 21st century. Talking to Nick this morning is Nathaniel Fogg. Nat is a private investor and a very trusted advisor in both the defense and government services markets with over 20 years of relevant experience. Most recently, Nat was an advisor to A&M Capital Partners and subsequently senior vice president for mergers and acquisitions and corporate development at Centerra Group, which was a portfolio company of A&M Capital acquired by Apollo in April of 2017. Prior to joining Centerra, Nat was a partner and founding member of the Chertoff Group, a boutique advisory and M&A firm specializing in national security markets. He also served at the Department of Homeland Security in the Bush 45 administration as Deputy Chief Operating Officer at FEMA, helping to restore that agency's damaged reputation and image in the post-Hurricane Katrina environment. Nat began his career as an officer in the United States Navy, served on various ships in the Atlantic and Pacific fleets as a surface warfare officer. He holds an MBA from Harvard Business School and a BA from Yale University. Nat remains a senior advisor to the Chertoff Group. He resides in Palm Beach, but I know a big part of his heart is right here on Mount Desert Island. So without further ado, let me turn the program over to Nick Dowling. Nick?
Thanks, Arthur. Morning, Nat. Good to see you. Before we get started, I just wanted to say a big thanks to Lynn Bulger, who puts the Champlain Institute program together every year. It's an incredible program, bringing to this small island diversity of perspectives, diversity of backgrounds on some of the most interesting and pressing issues. And she works tirelessly and brilliantly to do so. And I just want to express my personal thanks to Lynn for the work she does on that. And I'm particularly excited about having a chance to talk to my friend Nat about the incredible challenges we're facing as a country right now and how we as a country deal with disaster, with pandemic, with storms, with these crises. If 2020 was a movie, it might be a disaster movie. It might be a dystopian movie. I'm not sure. But I guess, Nat, we're going to talk about COVID. We're going to talk about some of your experience running or helping run FEMA during Katrina. But maybe the right place to start is, how's it supposed to work? How is the U.S. government working with other partners, state and local and so forth? How are we supposed to be dealing with a crisis, a disaster, when it happens?
Well, thank you, Nick. It's great to be part of the Champlain Institute, and I'm glad to be part of this discussion. It's a great question, and I think we're seeing it part of it play out in real time right now. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is the coordinating federal agency under the Stafford Act, which is the act that governs the response to national disasters from the federal level. So FEMA is the coordinating agency that directs all other federal agencies in the response to a national emergency. And there is also typically a lead federal agency, not always FEMA, such as in this case in COVID-19, Health and Human Services, HHS, is the lead agency. And once states request assistance from the federal government, then the federal government pushes in supplies and support to back up the state's response to that particular national emergency or disaster.
Great. Does FEMA do a lot of planning for different crises like pandemics, like hurricanes and so forth? And how do they do that planning to be prepared so that we know that when disaster hits, they're ready to go?
Sure. That's another good question. So FEMA has the National Exercise Program, and inside of the National Exercise Program, a number of different disasters are being planned for at all times throughout the year. And other federal agencies and state and local authorities are brought in to help prepare for those types of emergencies. There was and is a pandemic plan, and there are other plans for other national disasters, as you might imagine.
You jumped into FEMA in the Bush 45 administration right as it was grappling with Hurricane Katrina. I think the then FEMA director, Michael Brown, had just been dismissed by President Bush. Tell me about what it was like to come in the middle of an emergency like that, and what were the types of challenges, and what worked and what didn't work as you guys worked through the challenges of Hurricane Katrina?
Sure. So Katrina was an interesting one. Because the FEMA was put into the role of long-term recovery after the initial response was done. I didn't come into to the organization until the long-term recovery phase had already begun. So the response phase was under the previous regime at FEMA with Michael Brown. But by then, FEMA had been thrust into a long-term recovery role, which I think we quickly began to realize was not how FEMA was designed at the time. And as a result, we were left with all of these individuals requesting individual assistance, and they ended up in trailers. And FEMA was not well suited to deal with that long-term recovery case management problem. And I think that became a struggle with other federal agencies perhaps more suited to help with that problem, such as housing and urban development. But they were understandably somewhat reluctant to wade into that. And so part of our challenge at FEMA was to figure out how do we involve HHS with problems that the trailers were having, such as formaldehyde. People may remember that. And also helping housing and urban development wrap their arms around long-term recovery issues, such as case management and getting people out of trailers and into temporary housing and more permanent housing. And so there became a large effort at FEMA to reorganize the agency to make sure that when and if something like this happened again, that the right agencies were involved more significantly to take over after the initial response of FEMA to help with longer term recovery. And that led to FEMA developing a logistics capability that was much more robust than it had in the past, a mission support area that was much more robust, as well as a much better handoff process to agencies like HUD and HHS and others that were perhaps better suited to deal with the longer term recovery challenges that the aftermath of a disaster like Katrina offered.
Yeah, we saw, I think, in Katrina, some of the challenges of FEMA in terms of being able to coordinate with different federal agencies and state and local agencies, as well as the private sector. Some of those seams and gaps were exposed. At times, it seems like it's worked well, and at times it has not worked as well. I know a famous example where I felt like it worked well was Hurricane Sandy, where under President Obama, and when that storm hit the New Jersey coast and the New York area, you know, Governor Chris Christie, who of course later became a strong Trump supporter, Governor Christie and President Obama worked very closely together. Good example of bipartisan cooperation and state and local with federal cooperation. How does FEMA, what are the keys to make that cooperation work well, and what are the keys to make it sort of not work well? Is it all personality dependent, or are there some other things and lessons that we've learned in terms of how we develop good cooperation between the different players that need to be responding to a disaster?
And that's another great question, Nick. And I think the heart of it comes down to good communication and working hand in hand with our federal partners and also state and local authorities and law enforcement officials, and making sure that the federal government is being asked to come in by the states to backstop their efforts, and that there is a clear line of communication between the governors and their offices of emergency management back to FEMA and to the administration that is in place at the time. I think the other thing to note is that each disaster brings with it certain unique challenges. I think the Hurricane Sandy challenges that you refer to, I think we learned a lot about how the Northeast, how well prepared they are to deal with national disasters such as hurricanes and major category hurricanes, which do not affect the Northeast coast quite as regularly as they do down in the South, Florida, and then into the Gulf. And so I think there's unique challenges. I think we saw in New York, for example, that generators in hospitals were in the basement, and that was a huge problem because the basements flooded and then the generators stopped working. I think we learned a lot about where, power stations are in the city, and that, they're not necessarily in the right locations. So I think all of these challenges, present difficult things for FEMA to deal with and the federal government to deal with on the fly that they hadn't necessarily anticipated.
Great. Well, let's get into the COVID crisis a little bit. So we've talked about, that you need good planning and that FEMA does quite a bit of that, that we do exercises and training to be prepared for disasters. You talked a bit about FEMA and improving its logistics capability to have more supplies and ability to move different equipment and key things like that. And we talked about the importance of communication with different agencies. Talk to us about what you saw in the early going as it became apparent that COVID-19 was an emerging crisis, really around the world, but certainly for the United States, thinking about our country and our population. How well prepared were we for a pandemic like COVID-19?
Great question. As I mentioned previously, you know, with natural disasters such as a hurricane or a wildfire or a flood, you know, those states affected request an emergency declaration from the federal government because you know, these natural disasters only affect a certain part of the geography of the United States. So typically, you know, there's just a few states that are requesting a national emergency, and the federal government then pushes in supplies where needed to that affected area. However, as in the case of 9/11 and now the COVID-19 pandemic, the president may invoke Section 501B of the Stafford Act when a national emergency is deemed to affect the entire country. And so on March 13th, the president invoked that authority and declared a major disaster for all 50 states and territories. That has only been done a couple times in our nation's history since the Stafford Act has been put into operation. And one of those was 9/11. I think the other one was the space shuttle, but I'm not quite exactly sure. So, you know, I think while HHS was the lead agency for responding to the pandemic, I think this administration, and this is my opinion, I think this administration felt that HHS was perhaps not designed and built to handle the scale of such a response. And so I think this administration felt that invoking Section 501B of the Stafford Act and declaring a major disaster for all 50 states and territories was the best way to get the federal government involved and to have FEMA essentially become the operating arm of the federal pandemic task force. In terms of challenges, you know, which you allude to, I think this was the first time that the federal government had to say no to the governors and start to ration supplies. I think you will recall that we realized that the national stockpile had been depleted of PPE, face masks, surgical gloves, ventilators, and that there was a lack of supply. So this was really the first time in, you know, modern history that FEMA really had to say no to the governors and start to ration. So I think there was a lot of struggle with the governors, and there were some fits and starts. And as I mentioned, I think HHS was not built or designed to effectively lead this size of a response. And that is why I think the administration saw the potential for a failure of HHS and why they invoked Section 501B and declared a national disaster for all 50 states.
Let's talk a bit more about the PPE, because there's been a lot of controversy about that. As I understand it, the under the Obama administration, they had made a it created a policy to create a stock of PPE, but then they used a lot of that, I think, for the SARS epidemic. It was still a reasonable amount, but it was well depleted from what the national plan had said it should be. The Obama administration, after that, didn't replenish it in the remaining year or two that they were in office, and then neither did the Trump administration replenish it during their first year and a half in office, until suddenly the pandemic was upon us and we realized we had a shortage. Why is it that the U.S. government can make a plan saying we need this level of supply against this type of disaster, a disaster we knew was very likely to happen, and yet two different administrations by two different parties failed to replenish that stockpile? How does that happen?
It's a great question, and I'm not sure I know the exact answer to that. I don't think it was just the Obama administration and the Trump administration. I think it was also previous administrations missed the boat on things as well. Katrina, I don't think we were as prepared as we could have been for that disaster. I think each disaster comes with unique challenges, and I don't think anybody, after having gone through SARS, would have imagined that something like this scale of a pandemic would have affected the United States. And I come from a human experience of past disasters and terrorist attacks. You know, I can tell you my first ship was the USS Cole, and I was the damage control assistant. I left before it was bombed a couple days before, but I can tell you the United States Navy was not prepared for that, despite multiple data points that suggested that this type of an attack was a reality and potentially likely to happen. All I can say is I think it was one of these things where other events and other priorities overtook each of these administrations, and they left their eye off the ball. But I do think that once on March 13th, once the president declared a national emergency for all 50 states, FEMA really rolled into action, and they, created the air bridge, which rolled in 250 flights from Asia with PPE pretty quickly. It activated the Army Corps of Engineers, which, as you may recall, set up alternate care sites and built hospitals overnight, literally. They brought structure and logistics and planning into play. The administration invoked the Defense Production Act and embarked upon involving the private sector in bringing and manufacturing ventilators on an unprecedented scale, and also sending medical mission ships to the West Coast and the East Coast. So I do think that once the federal government wrapped its arms around the problem, the initial response for logistics was solved fairly quickly.
I'll give you a couple of my own thoughts, answering my own question about why I think as a government, we are often bad at following through on the plans and the scenarios we see. And that is, amazingly, as large and complex as the U.S. government is, we're really not that capable of focusing on more than one major issue at a time. Or at least not too many more than one. And so the political currency that we're going to use, an administration is thinking, okay, we're going to focus our attention on the Hill and on the state and local, on whatever that initiative of the day is, whether it's a tax package, or it's a infrastructure package, or it's a foreign policy issue. You know, yes, we've been briefed. We know that pandemic or terrorism is a concern, but it's not our priority. When Bush 45 came in, terrorism, he knew it was a concern, but it wasn't his priority. And so we saw how that flipped as a result of 9/11. You know, same thing. I don't think that pandemic was a priority of the Trump administration. And so what we see is that even though these panels and these agencies do really good job of sort of saying, this is what we need to do as a government to be prepared for this thing, the political leadership is really very focused on using its political currency for resources and for things like that, for its priorities of the day. And as a result, we continue to lag. And I think that's a tough one in terms of as a democracy that we have. But let me go back to another question for Nat, which is, we talked a little bit about the logistics. The other piece of it is, I would call more just leadership. And as this pandemic started to unfold, you had an incredible amount of doubt and uncertainty in the American populace. The medical community was still trying to figure out exactly how serious COVID was. The issue of what the right behaviors we could do to reduce it, to help shape decisions about what you do with your business or with your family or in your state. Guidelines about, you know, social distancing, about staying home, about wearing masks, all these sorts of things require essentially leadership. And in a time of national crisis, people look to the president of the United States for that leadership. I think this is arguably President Trump's biggest failure with COVID. When you're faced with a national challenge, a president who stands up and tells the American people, this is what's going on in a very calm way. This is what we're doing to address the issue, to give people a sense of optimism and a sense that we are going to get through this. Whether it's FDR and his fireside chats or in the wake of Pearl Harbor and so many other presidents, President Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis, that sense of leadership, that sense of we're all in this together. It's not about Republican, Democrat. It's about one country. This was an opportunity for President Trump to really demonstrate that he had those characteristics and really, I think, failed significantly. What's your perspective in terms of why we've seen so much turmoil and controversy and confusion about how serious this pandemic is, whether you should wear masks, all of that? What do you see as the problem?
Well, there's a lot in there, Nick. I guess what I would say is I would, speaking from the perspective of a former government official in a senior role at FEMA, I personally believe that FEMA gets a pretty good report card for their response. I think when they were operationalized, they did Herculean efforts on the logistics front. And, you know, I think with the air bridge and with logistics, they were able to push in more than enough supplies in terms of, you know, giving states a 60-day stretch of backlog of supplies that they can continue to use. And they were very well funded. They had $35 billion in the disaster relief fund left over from the hurricane in Puerto Rico. And then Congress allocated them another $40 billion. There's $75 billion sitting there in the disaster relief fund. And receipts from states total so far $7 billion. And FEMA has reimbursed them already to date for that. So I think
isn't FEMA is going to execute the guidance of the president. And it sounds like they've done some great work on the logistics side of it. But my question was about the broader leadership piece, right? Logistics alone can't get us through a national crisis. That conceivably is why the president set up this task force well above, right? Led by Vice President Pence, apparently. My question was about that broader leadership capability. FEMA is there to help execute, particularly on the coordination and the logistics piece. But what about that leadership piece about on policies, about making sure that federal and state governments are working closely together to give the American people a sense of what the plan is and how we're going to get through this? You know, why have we been struggled on that?
Well, again, I think I would offer that I think up until about a month ago, I would say people thought that things were trending in the right direction. And now I think folks are starting to panic. You know, I don't think that people expected the kind of surges that were beginning that we started to see in late June and into July. And I think up until that point, I think the approach and the guidelines and the communication between the federal government, the administration, and the states was largely fairly good. I think that has been challenged by these spikes. And I think that the federal government has been reluctant to mandate things like wearing a mask. They're uncomfortable doing things like that. And they have essentially pushed a lot of this decision making to the governors themselves. And I think it's going to be very hard to put that genie back into the bottle. So I appreciate your point of view. And I don't disagree that one of the most important things in a national emergency such as this is to have strong leadership and communication to the American public to make them feel like things are going to be okay. And I think that that was essentially the case up in into June. But I think things have changed, and I'm not exactly sure what's coming.
We've seen different responses by different governors. Obviously, the pandemic hit New York really hard early on. And then Governor Cuomo was very active and vocal, and New York seems to have gotten things under control. Contrast with Florida, where Governor DeSantis has been, also vocal about reopening business and reopening the state and so forth. And now Florida is really in hot water. Do you think that is the right approach, just to let each governor kind of like steer their own course? And then, of course, from the federal standpoint, that means they're not only are our lives at stake, but, you know, the federal government now has to swing resources between, oh, this state is doing it this way and that state's doing it this way. Or is there a role for the federal government to sort of provide more of a consistent sort of approach to this, rather than just saying, hey, every governor, you decide what's best for your people?
No, it's a great question. And, I think with more common natural disasters, such as a hurricane or a flood or a wildfire, we've had so many of them so frequently that there's not, the same kind of, health issues involved across the entire country. There's a sort of, more straightforward response to those types of disasters that, allows the Stafford Act to work as it's designed, to have the governors be the lead in their own states and have the federal government in a supporting role. I think from my perspective, what's presented challenges here is that once the federal government, had their initial response, and once it was clear that we had enough supplies, we had enough ventilators, and in some cases we had more than enough, then it was, it was clear that we were going to push decision-making guidelines to the states. And part of the challenge there is that, you've got this this dichotomy of governors wanting to look out for the economic well-being of their state and their citizens and their businesses within the state, bumping up against the health concerns. And I think, in a number of states in the past couple of months, American citizens have let their guard down. And I think you saw that in Texas, and I think you've seen that in Florida, and you're continuing to see it. I know for a fact that pandemic task force officials like Dr. Birx, when they went down to Texas, they came back up and told their counterparts that people were not following the guidelines. I think it was inevitable, when you do a look back at this, that each governor was going to come up with a different set of guidelines for reopening their economy. So to your question, I would have liked to have seen and would like to continue to see the federal government get more involved in having an alignment on communication of guidelines to the states about reopening of the economy and reopening of schools.
Yeah. We're in an extraordinarily partisan period right now. The antagonism between the parties is pretty thick. We're also in an election year, which, enhances that anyway. My own personal view is times of national crisis, times of war, times of national emergency is when we need leaders who are unifiers, whether it's governors, members of Congress, presidents, certainly, who are really working to bring the country together. And as we think about, what's at stake November 3rd and the election coming up, I think that's, from my standpoint, What I would really like to see is a president and a government that is more willing to work together, Republicans and Democrats, especially in times of crisis and disaster.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features a conversation between Nathaniel Fogg, former deputy COO and counselor to the administrator at FEMA, and Nick Dowling, founder and CEO of IDS International. They will now answer questions from the audience.
First question is for you, Nat. Why do you think there is a continued shortage of not only PPE equipment, but also testing supplies? What actually have we learned?
Well, that's a good question. The data that I have from FEMA suggests that we have a 60-day supply for all the states, and that the PPE that the states have requested has been provided. I mean, you can go onto the FEMA website and see the amount of PPE that we have. I think we have something in the order of 59,000 ventilators sitting in this national stockpile, which no one has requested. And, you know, millions of I think 189 million masks have been provided, surgical gloves, other types of PPE. I do share your concerns about how quickly they were initially provided. And I think that we covered that. And that one of the lessons learned that's going to come out of that is that we need to make sure that the national stockpile is continually replenished. With respect to testing, I think we were caught flat-footed on that as well. Lots of improvements have been made in that area, but I still think that testing is taking too long to provide results, and that the length of time that testing is taking to provide results is allowing people who got that test, who may still be symptomatic, to spread the virus. So certainly there will be a lot of lessons learned that will come out of this pandemic.
Yeah, I'll just add that I think the testing piece is incredibly essential, because testing is really what your key tool is to control the infection and the outbreaks, and to allow economies to reopen. If you have good testing and you can do good contact tracing as a result of that, you can really have control. And the fact that we're now, you know, what, 6 months into this crisis, and testing is still very limited in its availability. It's getting better for sure, and we're doing more tests every day. But why 3 months ago we didn't have testing available to everybody who needed it is another, I think, huge shortcoming that's really hampered our response to this. Next question. Can the COVID situation be controlled with federal oversight? Do you think, in other words, do you think we're getting to the point where we're going to be able to control this pandemic?
So that's a good question. I think we were just talking about it prior to the Q&A session beginning. My personal view, and I am not a medical doctor, is that the genie is out of the bottle, and that the United States and each governor in each state is not going to, across the board, re-shut down their individual economies. And so I personally think the way we're going is herd immunity.
Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize that neither Nat nor I are infectious disease specialists. We're not epidemiologists. Our familiarity and our experience is to how the federal government deals with crisis and disaster. So we will try to avoid the getting into the medical questions. Definitely important questions that we would advise you to certainly go to your local doctor, and also the CDC website has lots of good information on advice on things like that. Another question. Nat, do you think it's a good idea for kids to go back to school when they are mini germ carriers? There's a medical question, especially with the numbers going back up. And I guess you might think about that from a government, from a planning standpoint, from like a FEMA federal standpoint. how should we be making the decision about whether kids should be going back to school, whether it's at the school board and principal level decision or at a family level decision?
Well, as I think Nick alluded to and I did earlier, I cannot speak to the medical implications of bringing kids back to school. It's certainly a tough problem. I guess what I can offer is that I think it's a challenging economic problem for a lot of families if they're going to be faced with having their children at home while they try to go back to work, whether that's virtually or otherwise. And I think that's going to have huge economic implications, especially for lower income Americans who rely upon the public school system, for support for their children during the day while they work to put food on the table. So I appreciate that it's a difficult decision, but, you know, I'm certainly not in a position medically to make that decision.
Question for me is if, and we'll put this to Nat as well, but if I was working with FEMA or Homeland Security right now, what three actions would I prioritize to prepare for future emergencies and disasters? I think going to one thing we said is, are there better actions one can take to make sure that we are doing the things that our planning said we needed to do? So if you think about the pandemic exercises and the pandemic plans that we know were put in place that said we need a certain amount of PPE, that we need to be prepared to operate in a certain way, how do we make sure that after that important commission report has come out and the administration has said, yes, we should do this, how do we make sure that the government is better at following up on those things and keeping keeping the logistics and the supplies and the readiness to be prepared for those things? I think I don't have the clear answer on that, but I would want to look at that question about how we essentially do a better job of making sure that we follow through on the plans that we identify, rather than 3 years later when the contingency happens, we've sort of focused on something else. We never really followed through on the recommendations and so forth. So I think that would be sort of the main thing that I would do. I think the second piece I would do, and I'm just going to do two out of three because I'm only coming up with two, is really continue to emphasize the leadership piece and, getting Republicans and Democrats, state and local, and others working together regularly on these and practicing that leadership element and talking about that, I think is essential. Let's go to another question. Nat, based on your experience, what do you think we should be doing today and going forward about the COVID crisis?
Yeah, no, I've been thinking about this quite a bit, and I've talked to former colleagues who are currently in the government at Homeland Security and FEMA and other parts of the government. And I've used this expression before in this talk about not being able to put the genie back in the bottle. And I think along the lines of what Nick was saying, I would have liked to have seen the administration and the task force continue to be visible to the American public, to provide clear guidance, leadership, and communication to the American public. I kind of felt, as an American citizen, speaking as an American citizen now, not as a former government official, I would have felt more comfortable and confident had there been more consistent communication from this administration, during the shutdown. And I think that is a missed opportunity.
I'm going to ask a question on a slightly different topic. We're in an extraordinary period right now, not only because of COVID, but the death of George Floyd created this incredible call for action for Black Lives Matter and protests in cities around the country. many of whom have been peaceful and constructive and giving our nation and focusing our nation on the continuing problems of racism. But in some cases, you know, we've seen violence and we've seen issues. Right now you have in Portland, you have this these accusations that these unidentified federal police are, acting like stormtroopers. That's kind of the liberal portrayal of what's going on there. Should the federal government, in response to sort of instability and rioting and that, be getting involved in that? Or why aren't we letting the local police there handle that in their community?
Yeah, no, that's a tough question, Nick. And I think there's two ways to pose that question, right? Which is, should the federal government be doing that? And can the federal government do that? And I think response to the latter is they can, and they have a lawful right to do so. There's plenty of examples of federal civilian law enforcement agencies, such as the FBI or ATF, and even Customs and Border Protection, to do their job being pushed into different states to carry out the mission of the federal government. I think in this case, a lot of people are focusing on what has been going on in Portland. And again, I'm not an expert here, but my understanding is that the protests, while they may have started out focused largely on BLM and very peaceful, that they were going on for 50 straight days before the federal government actually sent federal civilian law enforcement. Again, want to be clear, these are not military officials. These are civilian law enforcement officials. And they were sent in to protect federal property, in particular this federal courthouse. Beyond that, with respect to the question, should they be involved, I think it's a slippery slope. And I think it's a very racially charged environment and a politically charged environment. And I think in some cases, protests that are underlying largely peaceful and focused on, the Black Lives Matter focus, I think have also been overtaken by other protesters that have different agendas. And I think we've been seeing that play out in certain cities, in particular Portland, where those protests start out fairly peacefully in the night, and then as the night wears on into the early hours of the morning, certain factions, criminal factions, start to attack federal property. And I think in that case, and in that scenario, the federal government is well within its right to protect federal property. But again, I think the answer to should they be involved is, I really would love to see in instances where this is unfortunately happening that state and local police are working hand in glove in coordination with federal officials to make sure that there isn't a real need for federal civilian law enforcement to push in and defend federal property. So I think you have a little bit of politics playing out there for sure.
Yeah, I agree with you it's not the optic that we want. Communities, these are largely peaceful protests, and to the degree that they do cross the line and people are damaging property or looting and so forth, that's an issue that's best resolved, in my view, by communities, by local law enforcement. And while, as you say, the federal government may have the right to go in to protect federal property and so forth, sending them in dressed, even if they're not military personnel, dressed in military style with camouflage and the type of PPE that military wear, that optic is, I think, not helpful and turns what is a local issue into more of a national crisis and really pits the federal government against the movement and against the state and local in a way that I don't think is helpful. So, you know, I think that's going to be another area where lessons learned in terms of the federal response to this type of political protest and unrest, you know, we're going to look at carefully because, you know, hey, we're a democracy. We need to allow and welcome and, you know, voices like Black Lives Matter to as part of our democracy. And we don't want to be seen as, in my view, as having the federal government suppressing that or stopping that or being opposed to that. And I don't think that that's what's happening. I think that I'm willing to give the benefit of the doubt that they are there to protect federal property, but it creates this impression of federal troops going in to snatch protesters, to arrest them and so forth. Not helpful. Well, let's go to one other question.
On
go ahead. Go ahead.
One last thing. You know, I would say that this is not happening all across the country. It is happening in certain cities. And I think with respect to Portland, you know, and again, I'm not an expert, but from what I've read and what I understand, certainly the police have been restricted from certain communication with federal civilian law enforcement officials, and they have been restricted in their ability to deal with some of these protesters. And so if you have a city government that is not going to allow its law enforcement to do its job, then the federal government is going to be forced to take action.
Right. I think we've got time for one more question. Question for you, Nat. Why do you think the federal, advice would you give to the next president concerning COVID-19 that he should take immediately in January?
Well, it is my sincere hope that by January we have a vaccine and that we are on a better trend line with respect to declining cases and getting this pandemic under control. But certainly there will be a number of lessons learned, and I imagine that there will be a number of planning exercises that the incoming president will pay more attention to. Certainly we will never be in a position again where we have a depleted national stockpile. I also think that, you know, lessons learned around alignment of communication and federal guidelines will be much more exercised in the future to make sure that when these things happen again, there is a playbook that is more aligned to reality. But again, you know, I think that there are instances of natural disasters, the likes of which we had not seen before when they happened. And so there's always going to be elements to these natural and other disasters, emergencies, where we're going to have to learn on the fly.
Yeah, I'll give my thoughts on that. I think even more emphasis than we have to make sure that testing and data collection on what's going on is more widespread. The more we know and can track infections and track what behaviors are linked to infection rates, the better. So that's one. Two, on the leadership side, you know, we talked about that more, but really bringing people together rather than dividing them apart and setting policies and guidelines to help the state and local officials understand what the best practices are. Third, really obviously full focus on vaccine and other treatments and looking to how we can most safely but effectively accelerate the development of vaccine. Not only development, but the logistics of then administering it are going to be a huge challenge. And above all, on all of those issues, listen to the experts, listen to the scientists, listen to the epidemiologists, the public health officials. Putting them out front, I think, is a key step that I would like to see more. So that would be my advice. I think that that about concludes it. But Nat, great to see you and great to chat.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk featured a conversation between Nathaniel Fogg, former deputy COO and counselor to the administrator at FEMA, and Nick Dowling, founder and CEO of IDS International. They recently spoke in a virtual environment through an online presentation as part of the 2020 College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute. This year's theme is November 3rd, What's at Stake? You can listen to all of this year's presentations online at coa.edu/giving/Champlain Institute. Stay tuned for more Speaking in Maine programs featuring talks from this year's College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute. If you missed part of today's program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.